Before we get started with today's show, I wanted to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Swaggoo and Perk, an ESPN podcast led by his namesake hosts Marcus Spears, Swaggoo, and Kendrick Perkins. With new episodes every Tuesday, Spears and Perkins will bring listeners the latest NBA and NFL news, as well as take a look inside their lives, career journey with can't-miss conversations. That's Swaggoo and Perk. Listen wherever you get your podcast, and also available on ESPN's YouTube channel. Also, the Peabody and Emmy Award-winning 30 for 30 documentary film series presents The Tuck Rule, a documentary that examines one of the most controversial plays in sports history. See the legendary Charles Woodson and Tom Brady discuss, for the first time, the call that changed it all. Watch live February 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, also available the next day on ESPN+. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It is Foxworth Friday. Dominique Foxworth, what's going on?
I'm just happy, man. This is what I'm here for, man. They put the black signal out.
Oh, yeah, it went up,
man. Are you working?
It went up. I got so many calls from the networks. I got a call today from a network I ain't never even heard of before. And thanks for watching on YouTube, by the way, everybody. We're going to talk about Brian Flores, all of that. But yes, I got a call from a network. It was a person I knew, but at a network that I had never heard of. The networks that I never say no to apparently were like, we ain't even going to waste our time with that one. Man, it was so busy. I got a text from ESPN Radio. And I had forgotten that I had gotten it to do Freddie Fitzsimmons. I got a text from a suit that night. Like, yo, did they hit you up? And I'm like, oh, my bad. It's like 9-something at night. And I'm like, all right, what time they want me on? 9:45. All right, cool. I guess we'll go ahead and do this. Nah, man, they ready for us, dog. They was ready for us to show up and make it happen. I saw Angela Rye on TV today. Welcome to the company.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised. I didn't know she was with the Disney family. But, yeah, they pulled out all the stops.
So we can talk about the same shit we've been talking about for almost 20 years.
Oh, man. Last night in our group chat, I was a little bit like, this always happens to me when these things happen, is for a second, I let y'all white people take my joy. And I get like angry and frustrated. But I always need good brothers like you to pull me out of that funk. And don't let him take my joy. Like, I was laughing at this whole thing. And yes, also, at the same time, trying to make important points that need to be made.
All right. Brian Flores is mad. That is that, like the number one thing. He seemed very calm and chill about it on television. Don't get me wrong. But this turn of events is a man who is mad. Let me tell you my number two read. This appears to be a man of principle. Mm-hmm. Right? For better or worse. Now, I don't know what all those principles are. But he does seem to be a man of principle on certain matters. And that's why I go looking at Stephen Ross. And this is why I say I laugh at Stephen Ross. Okay. Brian Flores is the man who is filing this lawsuit. Right? Young, in the prime of his career. He's not at you ain't never gonna get another job place. Right? We're not there yet. Right? That guy is filing this lawsuit right now. And why that makes me look at Stephen Ross funny is, let us say or assume that Flores is telling the truth, that he's out there on this boat and Stephen Ross just tries to serendipitously have Tom Brady show up, right? Let's say that it's true that Stephen Ross rolled up on Brian Flores and said, 100 G's per loss, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's say those things are true. You clearly did not get to know this man in the interview process. If the man who's ended up suing like this for the reasons why he's suing, if you ever thought to form your lips in front of this man and tell him, we gonna lose some games and I'll pay you some money to lose some games. Like, that makes me think maybe you did hire that man to lose. Because clearly you didn't get any handle on what his actual personality was. Or you just thought he was a patriot, right? It was just like, yo, you know how they do.
I get, yeah, they're willing to go in as far as it takes. But losing has never been part of the recipe. So, like, that seems like what is coming up to the surface. I mean, aside from this Dolphins allegations, is something that you and I have, like, talked about before, is there are black jobs. And one of the jobs that is tends to be a black job is when you are trying to tank and you don't care and you're like, all right, essentially, and I would assume that they're not dumb enough to do this, but maybe they do behind closed doors, but essentially like, all right, I'll take one for a few years because we're going to be down for a couple of years to their other owner friends. And then Brian Flores came in there and was like, nah, actually, I'm going to be much better than you expect.
Yes.
And you get fired for that is outrageous to me. Like, the goal of the job was for me to come in there and stink. I showed you that I don't stink. And you was like, nah, I don't actually want a good coach. Like, it just doesn't make sense. And there are other coaches that I saw you on a different one of the many outlets you were on. I can't remember which one it was, but I saw you pointing out that there are a number of other times where this has happened where they get the black job. And I was thinking after Urban Meyer got fired, if it wasn't for the fact that Trevor Lawrence was down there, it'd be 100% black job. Because when something's really messy, you got to bring in Dusty Baker,
yeah.
You know? You got to bring in a strong, older, trustworthy black, like the guy who plays the janitor in the movie.
Yeah, oh, they would have loved to call Jim Caldwell without no Trevor Lawrence. It's ironic because Trevor Lawrence is the reason why you should call Jim Caldwell. Like that's like, I think Leftwich is probably going to wind up getting that job, which is going to be interesting to watch him in. I understand how everybody feel about him now, but Whitlock wrote a column many years ago where I think he had reported this basically, but you remember when the Jacksonville depth chart at quarterback was Byron Leftwich, David Garrard, and Quinn Gray?
Mm-hmm.
And it was to stop him from calling for the backup?
Yep.
Right? Now, I think Shaq Harris was in charge there, so that was a black man being like, look, I know how these white folks do. Watch this. But, like, that's the city that we talking about here. Like, that man looked around and was like, no, we're going to need to do some things to make sure that everything winds up playing safe. So, like, if Byron gets that job, it will be interesting.
Have you talked to people around that team, though?
I have not.
Okay, well, I've talked to a couple people around that team, and the general vibe is it's a bad job, no matter who the quarterback is, because of the way that they run things down there. It seems to be kind of like half in, half out, kind of sloppy, and a bit frivolous is the term that I heard use. So, that's a black job.
Yeah, but he's in a trick bag because he needs to sell high, right? Like, you need to max out this Tom Brady value. And do that.
Oh, yeah.
But what you pointed out there is something interesting that happens with teams that I imagine among players is discussed more, but we don't talk about it nearly as much in media when we start talking about, like, good places to work, right? Mm-hmm. Like we think about it just in the context of whether or not you have a chance to win, but it's also the places that, like, it's free agency and they're supposed to fly you in and they don't get your ticket right. You know, you say you want a window seat, they give you an aisle seat. You don't think that's a big deal, but they're recruiting you. It's these little things that happen. And so when you talk about them being a half-in, half-out organization, I wonder often again, how often brothers have winded up getting these jobs, and then they get there, and they be like, dog, how many times do I have to call because my key don't work at the gate, and y'all swear y'all ain't fire me? You know, like, why is the ceiling leaking? You know, like, that kind of stuff. Like, why does this thing always happen? And Flores, I can't believe he did this. Like, I'm not saying that with any judgment. I just really can't believe he did this. And I watched him on Get Up, and I was like, oh, no, he means this. He's in on this. Like, this is a man operating from a place of sincerity. I don't think he can win this case. I think he can make some noise. But he really got up one day and was like, you know what? I've had enough. Who's coming with me?
I think it was when he responded to Bill Belichick with, thanks, Bill. Because you notice in the course of that text message, he was calling him coach.
Yes.
And then after he got to the end and Bill was like, my bad. Thanks, Bill. Like, that, well, to me, felt like when Flores dropped his phone.
Yes.
And started cussing.
And the thing is, Belichick is not the enemy here, right?
Not
like,
at
Belichick
all.
Didn't actually do anything wrong. But can you imagine the moment for Bill Belichick, right? And if you haven't seen this, basically, Bill Belichick is coach of the Patriots, and he has a former assistant named Brian Daboll, and he has a former assistant named Brian Flores. And he apparently typed Brian in the iPhone, and I know it's an iPhone because it was a blue bubble on the text. And so he put Brian in the iPhone, and he hit Flores when he meant to hit Daboll. And he congratulated Brian Daboll for getting the job with the Giants, not knowing he had sent that to Brian Flores, who had just scheduled an interview for this very job. And so when Flores responds, interview on Thursday. Yeah. And then Belichick is like, No, I talked to the guys in Buffalo and New York. You good, baby? You good? And Flores, that moment where he's like, oh, you, he says, Coach, do you think you're texting Brian Daboll or Brian Flores? Let us now imagine Bill Belichick's heart, his stomach, and of course, his booty. All three tight like drum. Right here. Dude, if I was Belichick, I would never have replied to that text. Yeah. I'd have run out of the room like I broke something in the store.
Yeah. The crazy part was he put BB at the end.
Yes,
like,
yes.
I like to think I'm a man of integrity, but I might as well. Oh, my kid's playing on my phone. Kid's playing on the phone. That wasn't me. He put BB on it to make sure y'all know.
Yo,
that's me. It's my bad. I'm a Navy man.
Yo,
midshipman. Let y'all know.
And even Flores, at least in the interview, we get up with Greenberg, who, by the way, did a great job on that. Like, you got three people up there. You got a lot of things to try to get to. And I also, you know, this is not company man stuff, but I mean this. They ain't had to get at 19 minutes, right? Like, they gave that a full acquittal to be dealt with. And so I thought Mike did an incredible job with it. And Flores didn't even seem mad at Belichick. He's like, hey, man, he slipped. You know what I'm saying? That's the game. Flores got his eyes on the prize. He's not just out here. He knows exactly who the white people are that he has a problem with. And he is setting his sights directly at them. John Elway, oh yeah, you can get it. Stephen Ross, my only assumption at this point can be that he had been preparing just in case to do something like this. Once he realized they was trying to lose, he needed to set himself up, like, to save himself in case they tried to fire him. But then that thing happened with the Giants, and he was just like, okay, run with it now. Like, you know how this can go sometimes in journalism, where somebody can be reporting on an issue, and then the editor calls and is like, all right, what you got? Today's the day.
Mm-hmm.
Today's the day. It's coming out. And that's what happened with Flores. He was like, nope, today's the day.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've been in save email mode before where you start sending me stuff that I don't like, and I don't know if I'm going to need it, but I'm going to keep it just in case. But
yes.
I do think that one of the things that came off that I thought was important, it shouldn't matter, but Flores wasn't, like, charismatic on TV as a TV person, but he came across as believable.
Yes.
And genuine. And, like, not too slick, not too prepared, and, like, a little fumbly in the way that you would imagine a football coach who has, like, found himself in this spot would be, which I think matters, and maybe it shouldn't, but I think it does matter because we know, like, page one in the perpetuate white supremacy playbook is to isolate an individual and to undercut whatever credibility he has. And I think that in Flores's case, like you mentioned, you don't think he's going to win it, in part because I think that there is enough in there for people to see themselves in the position of the decision makers. There's enough in there for people to look at him like, oh yeah, I can see how that happened, and it was in good faith. But if the rest of these, like Flores looking for the cavalry, if the Buffalo soldiers come with all of their paperwork, then it's a whole different story.
Yes, and that we'll see.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that with no judgment of these other dudes, just to be clear, because one thing about Flores is he did get his lick. He did get a score. You know what I'm saying? Like, he did get a chance to make 3 years worth of head coach money and all that stuff. And everybody got the flexibility to do that. Right. Not everybody's in a position. Like, I don't know how it went when he went to talk to his queen and was like, hey, baby, I'm about to sue the whole NFL. What you think?
Oh, man. Well, Flores is from Brownsville. I don't
yes.
know nothing about...
Home of the Brave!
Yeah. I don't know much about his wife or children or whatever. My guess is his children did not have a similar experience. But
no.
For Flores, I feel like $1 million is FU money.
Yeah.
Like, you know? So I'm sure he good, but talking to the rest of these folk is a different story.
Yeah, it just all depends on how much that money been saved. Because, look, he could have reasonably presumed that he would be making like $5 million a year for the next 20 years, right?
Yep.
And so if you made 20-year decisions based on that, then you may wind up having a problem. Because the other part, I'll never forget, my homeboy, Rodney Andrews, one of my favorite people. He's an economics professor. And I was talking to him when we was in grad school about, like, what jobs to take. He was married with, like, 4 kids, right? And Rodney was like, look, you have to understand something. My children, they into SpongeBob, their peer group. SpongeBob is what they do. That's what they about. He's like, there's no cutting off the cable in this house to go hard. He's like, if I come in and be like, yo, man, we got to go hard. They're going to be like, no, daddy, you go hard. Right? Like, you going to have to be the one to be on some go hard. So, if Flores walked in and was like, I'm about to take them all on. Colin Kaepernick, single man. Muhammad Ali, single man. Jim Brown, I think at that time, single man. Right? Married man. Oh, okay. So, she bought it too? She got
it's
an afro?
Decision. Absolutely a family decision.
And to be clear, I have no idea if she's capable of growing an afro, just to be clear. I'm just saying, like, I got some questions. Like, she sound like she B-O-U-T-I-T, B-O-U-T-I-T.
Gotta be. The next phase of all of this stuff is the interesting part, because we're going to move on. Like, the media in general is going to move on. Fans are going to move on. I've resigned myself to that fact, and that's part of the reason why I used to, like, lament when the black signal goes out, but now I kind of look forward to it because it's the opportunity that I have to remind people of all the stuff that they need to be reminded of. So next week, we're going to be all talking about football and Super Bowl. We're not going to talk about this again. The question is, right now, all the coaches, the timing on this was perfect. All the coaches who aren't in the Super Bowl are in Mobile, Alabama right now.
Yep.
And I don't know what they got down there. I don't know if they got a TGI Fridays, a Bennigan's, or something. But they need to rent them a back room or a black room. I don't care what you call it. And they all need to get in there. Because the thing is, there's power in the numbers. Not only does it make the case better, but it protects you guys. Like, you can blackball Brian Flores. You can't blackball everybody.
Right. 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 Y'all had a hard enough time finding the ones y'all got. And by the way, there's no afro.
Yeah,
just to be clear.
I remember when he got hired, I saw that picture. I didn't want to go on that, but yeah.
You know what that means too.
She could be an ally.
Yeah, no, that looked like when she was like, "Well, baby, look, I'm not trying to hear this right now from you. You don't understand what it's like." Like, I don't know how much a vote, like, in that situation, under those dynamics, like, when you as black man are ready to go hard in the name of the people, I don't really know, like, as non-black woman married to that person, I don't really know what your play is there.
I mean, I think you've already made your decision when you walk down the aisle, depending on where you're from.
That'll mean she knew that. That'll mean she knew that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
hey, man, we don't even know if her parents are on his side.
Yeah, that's true. That's my point, is they aren't on his side, that she already made this decision. She made this decision.
Oh, I got you.
You know what I'm saying?
You.
She's like, I'm in. I know what this is about.
Gotcha. Hey, maybe, right? I don't know, but he did it. And went on TV the next day.
This was strategy, man.
Yo, this man went and got the heavy-hitting lawyers, right? And apparently they think it's somewhat winnable, or at the very least that there's a shakedown potential here. Because these are people, if you don't know, who represented a lot of the victims of Harvey Weinstein. And so while Brian Flores is from Brownsville, home of the brave, he went to a prep school that's like the one prep school that's known for like recruiting athletes, but it's still a like fancy prep school nonetheless. And them dudes that went to them prep schools, man, you'd be amazed who they can pull out of their phone to give a call in a moment like this. And he got these lawyers and they're like, we going on TV too. And they sat up and they laid that case out. They didn't seem to be like performatively woke or anything like that. They laid out what this is. And so you're right, in Mobile, the black coach is going to need to huddle. But, I mean, there's going to be a lot of NFL media there. And we are going to find out who amongst our colleagues is a sucker, basically. There's nothing to stop you from asking these coaches some real questions. So, for example, Kyle Shanahan, go talk to him. Not to drill him against the wall, but just be like, hey, man, you got a black dude as your offensive coordinator now. You have a black dude as your defensive coordinator now. You had, I believe, Salah is Lebanese as your defensive coordinator previously. Was it that hard for you to find qualified people to do these jobs? And then when these other people come around, just be like, so how did Kyle find these people? How did Bruce Arians find these people? Just kind of curious here. Like, how did this all manage to go down? Can you let me know something? Can you tell me? But all them coaches are going to be there, and they may not be doing press conferences, but they will be available to the writers who cover them. General managers will be available to the writers who cover them. And then the Super Bowl is going to come around, and somebody going to earn his $40 million. Because, Raj, this is why they pay you. Come take these blows for the squad, dog.
He got to be sick. Like, they can't get this money back. If I'm Raj, he's coming up on his last press conference. I don't know when it's going to be, but it's soon. It's within the next few years. Like, if I'm Raj, maybe I'm saved it for the book so I can get another bite at that money apple. But, like, Roger Goodell And I was an opponent of Roger Goodell from a union standpoint for a long time. So by no means am I a Roger Goodell apologist or like Roger Goodell fan. He's done plenty of things that I strongly disagree with. Also, like, he's a decent person. You can sit and talk to him. He's all right by me. But I do know, based on his actions, because I don't pretend to be able to see into people's hearts. And like when Flores was talking about, I'm trying to change the hearts and minds of the owners. I wanted to drive to New York and flip over all the interview tables that he was sitting at, because he kept saying that you're not changing nobody's hearts and minds. But anyway, back to Roger. I'm not pretending like I can see into his heart, but Roger Goodell wants this to be different.
Yes.
Roger and the league office have done what they can do. They've presented rules. They've done all these things. They put pressure on them. And if you look at the C-suites in the league office, a lot of black, a lot of women, a lot of former players. Like, it's clear that he was deliberate about his hiring before he went and looked at the teams.
Yeah. I've said this about Roger for a long time. He's not the bad guy on this stuff. There's just nothing he can do. Like, one thing I was thinking about, I think I talked about this when I was talking to Dan on Wednesday. Owners are so much richer than they used to be. Like, Pete Rozelle, prior to Al Davis in that lawsuit, but even still a little bit after that, Pete Rozelle ran the league, right? Like, he was the commissioner and he was the guy who was in charge. But those guys, they had good money, or they had a lot of money, but they didn't have what is today's equivalent of billions of dollars. Those people were still beholden to other folks. Like, they still had to care what the public thought. These cats they got now don't have to care about it. Like, they don't have to give it a single consideration, but I don't blame them for thinking they don't have to, because think about how many times in the past we've seen this person is going to get hired, and insert NFL insider here will tell you they still need to satisfy the Rooney Rule, but they're not going into it. And this, for what to be fair, is not uncommon in all industries. Not every the job is open is we're conducting a broad search. A lot of them are, oh, I know who we want. And then you decide to go hire that person. Like, I remember when Mariucci got the job with the Lions, and it got a lot of hell because Matt Millen had just made it clear he wanted to hire Mariucci, and he was just disregarding everything else that happened. But I remember, I think it was King Kaufman who worked at Salon at the time. He made the point, no, what was far worse is that the Giants called Ted Cottrell in like 2-3 times the interview and then gave the job to Dennis Erickson. Like, they really didn't know who they were going to give the job to, and they were like, yo, the black guy, really? And then they just waited and waited and waited until they could find a better idea. And then they went and got a pedestrian coach. Like, Erickson was never a bad coach, but he was a pedestrian coach. And then they went and made that move. And so I look at how this plays, and that's one thing we do have to remember, is that when jobs come open, if people know somebody that they think they want to hire, that's typically the direction they wind up going in, and then everything else is like workaround. It just really hurts black people more because nobody wakes up. The only time I can think of somebody waking up and being like, we're going to go hire the black guy, was Jim Irsay when he hired Tony Dungy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was trying to think of another situation where that happened, but I can't. And I mean, I guess the Rooney Rule is, there's no reason to even try to defend it at this point, because it's clear that it doesn't work. But the Rooney Rule from the beginning, I think, was meant to be some sort of like trick. So like, I don't think that the purpose of the Rooney Rule was ever to get black people hired for that job as much as it was to change the perspective that teams had of particular candidates. So black coaches at a certain point were not even rising to the level of like interview candidate. Like, it'd be a bunch of interviews and not one black person show up. So the idea, I believe, behind the Rooney Rule was like, all right, then you'll have to find the best black candidates to bring them up. And then next time around, maybe someone will be looking for that guy because they remember him or they know him or they heard his name. His profile has been raised. But that obviously hasn't worked. And so I got frustrated on Wednesday on Get Up because my good friend Mike Tannenbaum was talking about solutions. And he brought up the idea of like filling the pipeline. And it's nothing against him, but just in general, like, I hate that, because y'all are willing to go outside of the pipeline. I shouldn't say y'all. Teams are willing to go outside of the pipeline. Like, the idea that there aren't black coaches out there inside or outside the pipeline that are capable is absurd, because y'all hire a dude with no experience.
They making the argument that the problem is we just don't know how to coach, or that we just don't know how to interview, right? Like, it's still inherently putting the blame all black people, even if you're saying, well, the problem is that white people don't know where to find the black people. Saying, where you find the white folks? They work in here. Like, you don't ever have no problem finding no black people to play football. And I bet you a whole bunch of them went to schools with a bunch of black coaches. Bunch of them. The coach at Abraham Lincoln High School, dog. Guess what? He don't look nothing like Honest Abe. Nothing at all. Right? And, but that's a key thing. And this is where we let white people slide, because white people are trying to let white people slide. White people are trying to come up with a way that is not just because white people be messed up.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's trying to get away from the idea. They do what they could, but there's just not a pipeline to show them who. And first of all, what if there ain't no pipeline, then what John Wooten doing over there? What is the Fritz Pollard Alliance if nothing but a pipeline? It's one man's pipeline, and that's a giant problem. And I say this again as someone who doesn't know John Wooten, who has no beef with him. It is not a criticism of the organization's work. I'm just telling you, if one organization has this much power in this, then it's a fundamental problem. You're going to find to talk to the black guy. Right. And you went and found a fairly moderate, which I do know about John Boone. It's not a judgment of him, but he's a moderate. He ain't burning nothing down. Right.
Yeah.
He's here to work with you kind of guy. And the thing that kind of sort of needs to be burnt down. Right. Like that's kind of where we are. But it ain't our fault. You're not going to be like, yo, we just don't know who the black people are. You put the black people in front of them and they still not going to give them jobs. It's going to wind up being something else. But that we need a pipeline implies that somehow the black people who coach are literally invisible, and that you yourself are not capable of seeing a black person and recognizing their capabilities. And if that's the case, say it. But when you say we need a pipeline, that is in effect what you're telling me. Because if that's not what you're telling me, then why do you need a pipeline? You should be able to see it yourself and be like, I don't understand. I see good black coaches all the time. Why can't you figure this out?
And that's when I get frustrated. Because then what's the answer?
Well, let me ask this.
Changing hearts and minds?
No, but I think we need to start doing this when people start talking about we need to come up with a pipeline. Because to me, NFL got one pipeline. There's only one coaching pipeline in the NFL. Nepotism. Like, that's the pipeline, if there is one, is nepotism. And the numbers bear it out. So, for the white dudes who aren't getting the nepotism bump, where you finding them? Why don't you go look over there? Oh, there aren't any black people there? That didn't make you ask no questions?
Yeah.
That didn't make you raise any point about, huh, I don't know what's going on. So, how about this? The Belichick tree, their pipeline is interesting. It's liberal arts colleges, right? Like, Belichick likes these guys from schools that don't play big-time football, right? Josh McDaniels, the Casario dude who works as a general manager now for the Patriots, those two dudes were competing for quarterback at John Carroll. Brian Flores, while you know Boston College is a football school, still fits what we're talking about if you know anything about Boston College as an institution. But this dude, Joe Judge, had his defensive coordinator, Patrick Graham. He went to Yale. Bill Belichick is out here finding football coaches at Yale, at John Carroll, and Wesleyans, you know, all these types of schools. And y'all can't find no black coaches nowhere else. Bill Belichick found, I mean, I don't know if Patrick Graham worked for the Patriots, but you get me. They found a black dude at Yale. You can't find a black dude in the wild?
You're making your point a little too well, because that's what makes me sad. And it's not just in football, it's society in general. Like, if you dig deep enough, you recognize that the thing that is messed up, you can't change. Like, there's no rule that's going to make people decent. There's no rule or incentive that's going to make people behave properly. Like, it just doesn't work.
No, white people stay asking us, well, what can be done to fix this? You think I'd be telling you? Like, you think if I had that one, it wouldn't have been done? What can we do to fix this? I need to ask you that. You the ones that know the people.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. They the ones that know the people. And they the ones that's putting that shit on me.
Yeah.
And I don't get it.
On February 4th, 2007, Tony Dungy and Lovie Smith became the first African-American head coaches to coach in the Super Bowl, with Dungy's Colts taking on Lovie's Bears. In a game which also featured a legendary halftime performance by Prince, Peyton Manning led the Colts to a 29-17 victory, winning the Colts' first title in 36 years.
It's tricky because, again, I think this lawsuit is not necessarily a great idea, but the more I talk about it, man, the more impressed I become with Flores. Like, the more I really appreciate the legitimate courage that this must have taken. Now, counterpoint, you could have quit as soon as that man told you that we was going to lose. You didn't, right? But I'm not blaming him for not being the perfect martyr. Like, that's not going to be it. He better be ready to answer this question. Man of principle, why does everybody say that you was the one that wanted Deshaun Watson?
Yeah.
That's going to be a question that he's going to have to answer, and a fair question, I think, to be asked under the circumstances, but definitely the one that he is going to have to answer. And it's entirely possible that the answer we're going to find out is that wasn't even really me.
Yeah, that's fine. And I mean, this is back to my original point, is I don't care. Like, I know it's a fair question to ask, and it's fine, but as long as we ask that question and we do not allow that to, like, undercut the point of all of this, what he is saying is true. It's very Kaepernick-esque in that point. It's like Kaepernick's not perfect. Wearing pig shirts or Castro shirts or whatever other stuff and being raised by white people, there's so many things you can use to try to give people a way to undercut Kaepernick. But there is no way to undercut what he was saying. And the same thing is true for Flores. Like, he wasn't good on the flag stuff. There's lots of stuff you can do to undercut Flores. And you could probably find ways to explain away all the things that are in that report. That's fine. That don't change the fact that it's true. that we all know is true. Like, no one's out here arguing. Find me anyone. Even the most, like, hyper far-right conservative, like, racist trolls that we have in this industry. They not even out here trying to pretend like it ain't true. They try to take shots at Brian Flores, but they not even like, nah, they just hired the right person. Best for the job. Like, I don't even see that nonsense on the internet no more.
Nope. You see it from accounts that don't exist. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. like, because I went and checked. Like, I checked, you know, I'm off the Twitter, but I went and checked my mentions after I went on Dan's show. And it's always interesting. It's like, you 2021. Your new account of 2021 has popped up on this. We haven't talked too much about Stephen Ross here, but I think that man gonna lose his team.
Yep.
And maybe he'll just deny. And I don't know what receipts Flores will have. But in the gambling universe, you out here saying I was telling these guys to lose? Can't have that. Like, that's how you know the NFL don't stand for nothing. Because not doing anything about race, I can't say that that don't mean that they don't stand for nothing, because that's just America. You know what I'm saying? But not doing anything about an owner saying we're going to lose out here on purpose, which is actually something that hurts the other owners, because when your sorry team comes to play us, how are we supposed to sell tickets?
It's not only that. Like, you know, I was a part of the negotiation, so I got an up-close look at how the owners feel about other owners. And after the Bengals won, I congratulated Mike Brown with his cheap ass, because I just remember how bad the owners would talk about Mike Brown behind his back. And it's not just about filling the stadium when your team comes to visit us. It's about the revenue sharing. So, like, if you are not trying to maximize your revenue, and, like, Mike Brown comes up because he won't sell the stadium rights, naming rights.
Because it's named after his daddy, for what it's worth.
Yeah, it's named after, that's fine. It's fine. It's a choice that you've made. But the other owners are like, fine, you've made that choice, but I don't have to subsidize it. Like, we are out here playing in Invesco Field or wherever. That's not even the name anymore, but you get the point. We selling all this, and then we got to send you money. Same case could be made when you are tanking. It's like, you are shorting your own gate and, like, shorting your own merchandise sales and your own concessions and your own TV, local TV rights or whatever, all the other stuff that they make money from. They're shorting that, which lowers their own revenue, which then forces the big money teams to send them a check. So before you even get to the gambling companies calling, because I guarantee you Roger's feeling those calls, mm-hmm. and some of them have good enough relationships that the owners are fielding those calls. Before you even get to that, you got to get past the other owners looking at you like, you stealing from me.
Yo, if you want an insight into Mike Brown, by the way, I don't remember this happening in your negotiations, but I remember this. Mike Brown, in part, did not want to shorten the preseason, because one thing Mike Brown does not want is home games in December. He's like, it's cold. My fans don't want that. Now, of course, this is also why he was asking them to come watch sorry team. So they really don't want to sit in the cold. He was like, my fans would much rather have a couple of preseason games in good weather. They do not want to come out here. I was like, wow, your dad is like top five football coaches of all time.
Yep.
And you're a football man, too. Also, Mike Brown's like 85. But, like, mm-hmm. you know, Mike worked as the GM and all of that stuff, and he gets zero respect. Zero respect.
He looked so bored when he got the trophy, too. He ain't want to be there. I got some stories, too, about Mike Brown cheaping people out, where they all, like, coming home from the combine or something, everyone will go and get into their cars because they have cars there to pick up all the coaches and GMs, except for the Bengals. Bangles out there catching cabs to the airport, riding the shuttle to the rental car station.
What, they reusing jock straps?
Yes, that is an infamous story. Oh, goodness. But they're going to the Super Bowl now.
Can't believe they're going to the Super Bowl.
And he complains about the cold weather, but refuses to get them an indoor facility to practice in.
That is the single cheapest thing that anybody in the league does. And it's not like, because it's not like Cincinnati is a little cold.
Yeah.
It's a lot cold.
I feel like the cheapest thing is, I don't know if they've changed this, but for a long time, they pretty much only drafted from like the Big Ten because they only pay for local scouts. And like, they didn't have national scouts. Their scouts were just like, hey, we a Midwest team, baby. Unless there's like a big star out there that we all know about, we're not digging down in the crates. And like, they re-sign all their players because they're like, nah, we ain't going free agency. We're just going to renegotiate this guy a year early while we still got some leverage.
Hold on. I have to look this up. This thing about the draft picks. I can't wait. I'm going to get to Mike Brown takes over the team at like 89 or 90. Ooh. So it doesn't always go like exactly, but I can kind of see where people might have been coming from, at least on first round picks. I could see how baby this is. Yeah, that'd be hilarious because they do have the slim scouting department. It's kind of amazing they put together the team they put together, you know, the 10 years ago team.
Yeah, I mean, and it's obviously changed some now, so maybe their scouting department has expanded, but they still didn't put together a Super Bowl caliber team. Right, I don't give a damn what nobody says.
But to our previous point that I was discussing, Mike Brown ain't that rich.
That's fair.
His dad was a football coach, right? His money is in this team. Like, he was running this team like what it was. The family business.
Yep. I bet they can't wait to get him to sell.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm waiting for the black owner that they're going to bring in. Because they're going to bring somebody in.
Well,
he's going to be thoroughly vetted. And we're going to put a bunch of celebration on him like he's going to be a change agent.
Crush your heart. He's going to crush all your heart.
That's exactly what I'm leading up to.
Yeah, like again, there's 30-something billionaires in the NFL that own NFL teams. It's 7 black billionaires in America. Total. All of us. And you know half of their names. Right? Like white folks got billions of dollars. You ain't never heard of who the hell they are. Us, Oprah, Tyler Perry, Jordan. Jay-Z, I think Dr. Dre got his ass up there, right? Like you got to be, it's the Chris Rock joke. Like Mary J. Blige live in my neighborhood. Eddie Murphy live in my neighborhood. My next door neighbor is a dentist. Like this is...
old pull-your-tooth dentist.
Yeah, like this is what the game winds up being. So I seen something that investor dude Robert Smith, there's been some talk about maybe him putting in a bid for the Broncos. First of all, he ain't getting it because he just snitched on his friends on that tax evasion situation. And so the rich people are definitely probably not going to let him in. But number two, I don't know why people think that a black owner is any different than a white owner is going to be. I have no clue why people think you did not get $1 billion by prioritizing black people. That's not how you get $1 billion unless you're selling us something we really don't want.
Or by making white people uncomfortable. Like, you did not, like, in order to affect the change that people think that having a black owner is going to affect, you're going to make a lot of white people uncomfortable. You do not become a black billionaire by saying or doing the things that make white people uncomfortable. I am certainly not stepping out to, like, call these people names or judge them in any way. I'm just proving the fact, like, I've been in some of these rooms. Like, I went to a fancy business school, and I understand that the next step, if you're going to go to a consulting firm after business school, if you're going to work your way up, you are going to have to make the people above you. Like, nobody is so talented that it doesn't matter how you treat people, and it doesn't matter how you make powerful people feel. If you are going to climb up to the top of an investment firm, if you're going to climb to the top of any business, if you're going to make deals, if you're going to get in on the ground floor of amazing investment opportunities, if you are going to do anything in this country that gets you anywhere close to $1 billion, you have to make white people feel okay. That's it.
Well, yeah, and on top of that, you know how you make $1 billion? By dedicating all your energy to making $1 billion.
Yeah,
I mean, that's just what it is. In the pursuit of that level of craving capitalism has never been good to black people, has never been good for black people. And a lot of the way it works is by holding black people down. I don't know why you think these people got $1 billion. Then they go on a football team and then treat everybody nice. That just doesn't make any sense. Like, I talked to Koppelman about this with, you know, he makes billions.
Right.
And he was talking about, you know, when the Axelrod character was there, he's like, all these people who told me they loved Axe and now they don't like him anymore because he's gone bad. What show have you been watching? But people just don't, they really believe that you can make $1 billion being good.
Yeah. I mean, in being well-rounded to the point that you were approaching there too is like, if you know anybody or you've been around anyone who's like the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, they're not really doing a bunch of recreational reading. Like, and if they are, the only reading they're doing is emails and contracts. And if they find some time for recreational reading, they're not reading The Wretched of the Earth.
Like, right.
That's not what they fill in their brain with. So even if they have the like emotional build to challenge something, many times they don't have the knowledge or the background, and their worldview is shaped by the people that they spend their time around. And that's why you often see, like, you rarely see a broke black Republican. Like, mm-hmm. It ain't a thing.
Yeah, you'll meet broke black conservatives, not broke black Republicans, right? It's a little bit of a different line. And again, like we talk about this, man, white folks just don't think we smart, man. Yeah. Like, we start talking about this coaching thing. I made this point to Dan. You and I are both very good friends of Mina Kimes. Mm-hmm. Mina Kimes is like a next level type genius brain, you know, like, because Mina does this stuff. Like, Mina also like paints and does Etch-a-Sketch, like actual real life Etch-a-Sketch type stuff or whatever. Like, she's wild brilliant. People get so excited talking about how smart I am. Mm-hmm. Like, I've been dealing with this with promo and the other stuff. I'm like, look, man, we can't be focusing on this smart stuff because ain't nobody trying to go do no book reports. You know what I'm saying? But they're so locked in on that idea because they just can't believe it. Like, they can't believe that I would be that smart. Nobody is shocked at how smart Mina is, right? Like, they take that That's as fair. Something that they think it is, right? And this is obviously not any shade to her. But the way people talk about how smart I am versus the way I find they talk about her is not because they think I'm way smarter than her, right?
Right.
They just think it's a lot more shocking that it's coming from me.
They talk about you like you a white cornerback.
Yes.
And they see Mina, like, oh, that's a black cornerback.
Yep.
Really good black cornerback, but she's doing black cornerback things. Then you walk in the room.
And don't get me wrong, they done tried to move me to safety a couple times. You know what I'm saying? like it's been a couple plays. They're like, yeah, I don't think he can cover that guy one-on-one. Like, I've definitely caught that. It's just because they don't think we that smart. Yeah. And, you know, for me, it's wild because I grew up in an HBCU universe, right? Like, I grew up early time, basically just around a bunch of black people before we moved to Texas. And so I was never in a situation where I had ever considered somehow I wasn't supposed to be something. Like, that was never a thought. But I know that that's the way people see us, right? And it affects the way that people see me. And so for these owners, I don't know how you get them to hire a black coach when you got to get them to overcome. It's just as hard as getting them to sign a white corner. They're like, yeah, he ain't fast. We know he ain't fast. Why are we, like, why are we doing that?
Say differently.
Yeah, like, wow, you just ran a 4.2? Huh, wonder what's wrong with the watch?
I think we need to start a black coaches and white corners union.
Yes.
Like, if we can get them together, that anything is possible in the league.
Yes, and he'd get Dustin Fox to be the face. My favorite things was I talk about black coaches and somebody's like, well, what about more white running backs? I'm like, yes, go talk to the white people and ask them why they won't do that. And see, what's wild about that, one of the things that people brought up with John Gruden was that his teams were disproportionately white compared to the larger sample and used that as an indicator of the racism, right? Which I see where you're coming from. But who's some of them white people? Hunter Renfro, Max with two X's. He's the dude that's out there, right? You could say the same thing about Bill Belichick, but I always argue with Belichick, though, was Belichick found a market inefficiency.
Boom.
Right? He's like, yo, y'all sleeping on Chris Hogan, Julian Edelman, Wes Welker, all these guys. You know what I'm saying? It's just like, yo, I caught y'all slipping because y'all are so down on your own people. Dabo Swinney went out there and got Hunter Renfro. He's like, I was a wide receiver. I see something in you. And that dude's a legitimate NFL player. Like, he ain't no, oh, I'm so happy for him. No, he's quick. Like, he can move. Like, he legitimately, there ain't that much of a difference between him and, like, Kadarius Toney in terms of what somebody's asking for from him and what he can ultimately produce. But y'all be doing it to your own. Y'all like the Africans that won't hire a black man to coach the soccer team.
You could argue that that is another market inefficiency that they refuse to exploit. in black coaches. Like, even if we assume that the talent level is the same across the races, like, you can assume that you're finding all the great black coaches because they're not getting chances.
Yeah. Here's what I need to find when we talk about the white quarters. You go talk to, like, a black – like, I was reading – I think it was Eldridge Dickey's wiki page. Eldridge Dickey was quarterback drafted in the first round by the Raiders, who was not so long after converted to play wide receiver. For what it's worth, they had Ken Stabler. So, you know, there's a lot that is going on, but apparently the heartbreak of never getting to play quarterback stuck with him. You know, he wound up strung out. Like, that's a very similar story for Joe Gilliam in the way that it played out with him as being a quarterback. Dog, there's some white man somewhere – fast as lightning, watching football, drinking a 40, mad as hell. Watching that one corner get toasted up, right? And just at the crib, like, why couldn't that be me?
You said some white man. Some white men across the country. And they are using all types of terrible words to talk about.
Yes, I want to hear about them. I want to hear their stories. You know, we talk about all the brothers that never got a chance, man. See, this is why these white folks be so mad and ready to burn shit down. Because they got stories of heartbreak, of discrimination. Yeah. And don't nobody want to hear them. Well, Bo Jones care, if don't nobody else care. Come up here and tell me your story about how you was fast, you could cover, but ain't nobody trying to hear it.
We got to, I mean, no, maybe not, but I do want the voicemail line opened up at some point.
Yes, there's going to be a bunch of calls from Dustin Fox using assumed names.
Oh, man. I talked to him after I called him out on the show and said that I was bothered that he got drafted in front of me. He reached out to me and I talked to him. And he was like, they changed me to safety the very first day I got there.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Because we all got the same guy in common. He has a client connection.
Oh, nah, he just reached out to me on Twitter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but I did what he said. Then he said, yeah, they put me at safety right away. They hit him with the doke. And remember, he always says the only guys that said he had a real chance, that gave him a chance at corner, were all black dudes.
Yeah.
Mike Tomlin, Mel Tucker.
Not surprised. Not surprised, but they experienced the same thing. Right. Had we only had these stories out before January 6th, would have quelled a lot. They just want to be heard.
Yes, they do. And I do believe there's actually a thing about a certain class of white people who just aren't heard. Like poor white people in particular, man. I ain't got nobody talking for them but Joe Burrow, who I guess we'll get around to talking about next week. But yeah, they ain't got nobody standing up for them but Joe Burrow. Like, I do feel like that's a thing. And like, it's a small little thing, but it's the same people. They be mad at us. It's the same people holding y'all down as holding us down.
Yeah.
You think we want to take 300 carries a year at them prices? No, send some white dudes out there to do that grunt work. Let Rex Burkhead get 400 carries, please.
Oh, man. You are absolutely right. No, I believe that. It is too much. I mean, over the past 4 or 5 years, a lot has been made of like the disgruntled poor white person. But I think that's probably a fair point. It's like, don't nobody. I get on TV every chance I get. You give me a crack and I'm pivoting to black people issues on TV. And it, all the white people that are on TV, they like, oh, well. We not pivoting to no, I don't know, no West Virginia problems. Like, I ain't too worried about that.
Did you read Hillbilly Elegy?
I did.
Okay, I think we may have even talked about it here, but I read Hillbilly Elegy because they was telling us when Trump got elected that we need to go learn something about these white folks. And I was like, actually, I know a few of them, right? And not just the ones I met in school. Like, I got a little handle on this, but okay, I read it. And I was like, oh, what an interesting tale. And if a black person talked about black people like he talks about these poor white people, we would not be here for it. Right? Like, it was just like, no, not here for that. But he did it with love, right? Like, it was very, I have an affection. And then that man ran for Senate, and it don't sound the same no more.
It don't at all. I find it, I mean, I don't know what the difference is, but, like, there is some understanding from white people, and maybe it's just because I'm, the poor white people that I've been around in my life were also football players, which also gives them access to the black experience in a way that a lot of people don't have. So, like, I find that those people with those accents that make me nervous, if they have played football, and not always, because sometimes it doesn't work out, you play football in the South all the time or something, but if they play football long enough that they understand and appreciate, and I can communicate with them in ways much better than I can with people who would look like me. It's a weird thing. Like, Jeff Saturday is one of the people I love and trust the most in this world. And if I just ran into Jeff Saturday after he came from hunting duck and I had never met him before in his pickup truck, I'd be like, I don't know about him. But it's something about his experience that makes him like feel like a really good, honest person that I can trust.
Yeah, you need a more acute eye. I knew Jeff. Like, I, you know, I didn't expect Jeff to be, as shall we say, culturally versed as he is, but he ain't the one to watch out for in the truck. It's different. Like, I got a different eyes. You know, like, oh, it's not him. Oh, no, but him. Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in Texas.
I know. Yeah, that's because the white folks you need to be scared of in Baltimore don't drive trucks. You act like I ain't watched The Wire season 2, brother. I know they there. I know they out there. I know what they hitting on. That's all I'm
it's
saying.
It's so funny. Like, I feel more comfortable around them. I know they up to something, but I feel more comfortable around them. When my few months in Atlanta, when I played for the Falcons, and we lived and worked in Flowery Branch, so, like, we weren't in Atlanta.
Yeah.
When I was driving around, I was nervous.
Yo, let me tell you this about Atlanta before we get out of here.
Nighttime?
It's just a wild thing about Atlanta. So, I want to say this is like 2011 or 2012. Now, for those of you who don't know, I went to college in Atlanta. In 1997, 2001, I went to college there. My parents have lived in Atlanta from 97 since, right? So, like, for my adult life, I've spent a lot of time in Atlanta. Let's put it like that. And my life is not a segregated life. Like, I spend a lot of time interacting with white folks, and I'll kick with white folks and everything else. Cool. I was at this bar with Spencer, and we're sitting there. And I forget what the theme was. I don't want to say medieval doesn't feel right, but it was a very Caucasian establishment. Sitting there with him, and I'm looking around, and I stop and I say to myself, I've never hung out with a white person in Atlanta before. It hit me. I was like, I don't have any white friends in this city. I feel like it might be the only city in America that I would say that about. But I was like, I don't. Well, other than Spencer, who's obviously my very good friend. But I was like, I don't have any white. And that blew my mind. Like, I had never noticed how segregated Atlanta was until it hit me at that moment. That, like, yeah, nah, I don't be kicking it with no white people here ever. Ever.
It's an unusual place. I told you before, as soon as I got traded, Champ and I were close and still are close. I got traded, and his advice to me was, he's from Georgia. He went to UGA. Mm-hmm. He's from some backwoods place in Georgia.
Yes.
And he was like, just remember that when you leave Atlanta, you in Georgia. And I knew exactly what that meant when I got there, because I go out to get gas at night, and it's 4 pickup trucks with Confederate flags on them at the gas station. And maybe you are not concerned about that, but me, with my northern sensibilities, oh yeah, I called my dad and had him on speaker just in case he needed to call on people. Not that they was going to help.
Yeah, you got to go a couple steps past the Confederate flag. Next door neighbor I had growing up had a Confederate flag on his truck. He couldn't have been nicer every time he came by the house and needed anything.
That's
like,
the sad part.
Like, I was just kind of like, oh, okay, this is not where I'm drawing the line. Like, if you wave the Confederate flag at your business from a pole, hey, what's going on? Every day, man, they ain't thought about this. They ain't even giving, like a 17-year-old, you ain't even giving this much thought. This is how you learn to live being black and southern. But that right there. Dominique Fosworth. Check him out. Get up. Undefeated. Debatable. All kinds of places. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. Thanks for joining us on YouTube. Remember, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars, I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.